Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism to order, and I want to welcome everyone. This morning, we have present Representative Higgins, Representative Gaddis, Representative Drummond, and myself, Representative Hughes. And as usual, we're expecting a few others. I want to thank our A-team. We have Henry and Debbie on left and right, and thanking them. And I also want to thank my staffer, Ginger, who just stepped out, as she's worked on a lot of preparation having to do with today's meeting, which I think you know that I'm quite enthusiastic about. This is something that is technology. We'll learn today that it's not brand new, but it is something that is really on the brink of becoming something big. And as I did share some on the House floor, I'll just reiterate here that I was looking at this. I had Alaskans, constituents come to me with concerns about the privacy related to the unmanned aircraft vehicles or systems, and I took those seriously. But as I began to read and study and research and realize what Alaska was doing, I thought that the best approach was to take this technology that is definitely moving forward and harness it for good, and that we could look at some of those other concerns as we learn more about it. And so the resolution that I have is not scheduled today. Because of the timing and the rules, we couldn't get it up today, but we are going to start to talk about it, and then Tuesday we will hear the resolution. So I do ask that you consider what you learned today, take that into consideration for that hearing on Tuesday. And I'm very excited. Down from Fairbanks, we have retired Air Force Brigadier General Ro Bailey here from the, let's see if I can say it right, the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration. And she is going to be bringing us up to speed on what we need to know about the unmanned aircraft systems and what Alaska is doing. And she has brought with her up at the table there Scout. That's Scout, her unmanned aircraft there. So we can learn a little bit about what that particular creature costs and what it can do, and the potential with bigger ones as well. I understand they can be from 4 ounces to 12 tons or something. So we'll go ahead and let her begin. And Ro, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Hughes. I appreciate that. My name is Ro Bailey. As introduced, I am the Deputy Director of the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Integration, System Integration. And there's another piece to it we don't put on because it's so long. That's research, development, testing, and evaluation. And that piece of it is pretty important because that is how we make sure what we're going to do is, in fact, appropriate. So what I'd like to do today is to take you through some of what we have done as a university. We've actually been doing this for almost 13 years now, and I'll talk about some of the projects we have done and why these projects matter to Alaska. I'll tell you something about a proposal we're working on right now for Alaska to be one of the test sites that the FAA is screening for. I'll talk about privacy and just a little bit about the resolution. But before I do that, I want to give you something to relate to on this. And, oops, I hit the wrong one. Try the other one, that one. Okay. So, let me make it large. This is just a little short video, but the first thing you're going to see on here is actually David Giesel. So let me.
Green, the system's ready to take off. You click that, then you click the takeoff button, and it pops up to 3 meters in this case. And you just take your altitude slider up, fly out to where you want to get your imagery, hover over your imagery, take some photos.
That's this aircraft. This is actual aircraft. Actually, this is actual one.
Scout was best described, I heard, by a reporter during one of our operations as a flying smoke detector. It's about 8 inches in diameter disc, it's about 3 inches thick, and it has 4 arms that stick out of it with the propellers spinning on the arms, all up on some landing gear.
I'm David Giesel from the University of Alaska, and we just finished our Scout flight here on the beach, and our map
map of this island of Seguam is clouded over, so we had to fly by the camera. So we set up these little points of interest along the shoreline to give us kind of a point of reference. Ready?
Yep. To fly the scout, you really don't need to see it. In fact, the operator on that tablet usually is operating with his head down. Someone else is keeping an eye on the plane or the area around the plane just for safety to make sure we know where it's at and what else may be out there. But the aircraft itself, technically, you can fly it out and you can sit in a room and never see it. You can bring it back and land it. You'll never have to look at it.
So this whole interface is pretty simple. On this half of the screen, you have your map, and you can pan the map around. You can zoom in and zoom out. This is where you control your flyer also. This is your altitude slider. You can take the altitude up and down. And to pull the slider in any direction, you just click on the screen, and it will fly to wherever the stylus is pointing.
HD video camera that we tested in the Aleutians, that actually was the first time that payload had flown for any operations. In fact, we got the prototype, the number one prototype from the manufacturer as they're trying to develop this as a new product. And so we gave it a good first crack test. Tell from the video.
It's as high as I can get.
So the scout fully loaded, the battery, the camera, and weigh up just under 2.5 pounds.
We just finished our 29th flight, so we've done 29 flights. We have like 5.5 hours in the air now, about 53 kilometers of distance flown, and something like 60 gigabytes of data collected between the video and the still imagery that we've shot, so quite a bit.
We'll fly in conditions that are beyond its flight performance. If it can only fly 31 miles an hour forward, it can fly in winds that are higher than that. It just can't fly forward in winds that are higher than that. The rain, I've never flown it in just a pure downpour. We've regularly flown it in showers that are soaking your clothes. We've flown it in snow. We've flown it in all kinds of conditions like that. Never would fly it in a sleet, you know, essentially freezing rain that would be sticking to stuff. And we've had those opportunities when we're in the Aleutians to fly in those weather conditions, and we wouldn't fly those days.
Wait for him and bring her down.
Landing onto the boat has been the hardest thing to do. The scout will hover in the air in a fixed position, but the boat is rocking underneath and moving. And also the wind currents coming over the boat change a lot, so as the flyer comes over the boat, there's a wind shear and it shifts from steady wind out over the ocean to changing wind over the boat, so it gets a little bit squirrely.
Here you are looking up in the sky trying to see the scout. The boat's moving and rocking underneath you. You have no perspective of the, you know, where you're at, you know, relative to the boat. You know, you're feeling your way around on the ship deck with your feet, looking in the air. You totally lose perspective. Kind of like if you look up in the sky, like what's going on, you know, you kind of lose where you're walking, which direction you're going. Not a real comforting feeling when the boat's moving around underneath you and there's stuff on the deck, you know, boards and other things that you trip on. So spinning propellers, if they hit me in the arm or the hand, there's a chance they probably could have broke my skin and I could have cut me. Well, I basically wore a chainsaw helmet. So I wore, you know, essentially a hard hat with a little face visor, so the face shield on the front of the helmet that would give me a chance that if the propellers, for some reason, I only got a hold of it partway, it would come loose, it wouldn't hit me in the face.
I think we've polished our technique. We've done 12 ship landings, 4 of them were a little bit chaotic and 8 of them were pretty good.
I think some of the ship crew expected us to fly 2 or 3 times total during the entire trip. You know, we flew 39 missions. So there were a lot more flying than I think anybody anticipated from the boat. So we never tried to launch a scout when we couldn't launch it, but we did launch the scout a few times where we probably regretted launching it because we launched it and all of a sudden the winds were just a lot worse than we expected once we got off the ship deck. And we dealt with it. We actually went and took images. We just cut flight short to come back early to make sure we had plenty of time to get it back.
When operating in the Aleutians, 25 knots of wind is not high wind. That's a normal day.
So the technology exists, and it's useful for many applications beyond its original design, you know, for military missions, for example. Designing the operation and understanding what you expect to get out of it, is where I see a lot of room for increasing knowledge. Knowledge about the limitations of the technology as well as the benefit of the technology is key. And the only way you're going to get that is by getting out and getting some time on it.
Sorry about that.
Bro, before you go on, I had a little bit of trouble hearing Greg. Actually, I had a lot of trouble hearing Greg a few times. And at one point he said something, there were a couple times they regretted launching it, and I couldn't hear what he explained. So because anything that he said that you think we should know, could you repeat it?
Sure. And I should say, this is Greg's representation. He is the director of the Alaska Center. And he's in Finland right now, and he's actually working with the government of Finland to show them what we can help them with and what sort of things this can do. But the things he was saying is there are a couple times we launched when we regret it because the weather conditions became so difficult that getting it back was worrisome. But they did. They just brought it back a little more quickly, a shorter flight time.
Okay, so thank you. I'm going to interrupt for a second and let the record reflect that Representative Tarr has joined us.
Okay. Other than that, he talked a lot about the benefits of the technology, that we still have a great deal to learn about it and from it, and that is what our effort has been at the university over the last 10 years. So most of everything else he said we're going to cover as I go on through this. So let me go on, if I may. So our history began back in 2001 when we were working with the New Mexico State University with the idea of developing some applications for these things that would be civilian uses. We've since been funded to work with the Air Force, with the Coast Guard, with a whole variety of other organizations. We acquired our first owned by us aircraft in 2006, and that was a Scan Eagle. You'll see a Scan Eagle a little bit later, but it's quite a bit larger than the Scout. It's a 40-pound fixed-wing aircraft, gas-powered instead of battery-powered. It has the ability to fly up to 22 hours and up to 23,000 feet, whereas with a Scout, you're looking at 20 minutes, and it can get up to about 1,000 to 1,200 feet. We mostly fly it under 400 feet, but it can do that. So you can see some big differences in capability. Since then, our missions have expanded, a variety of different science projects, emergency response, and I'll be showing you some specifics on some of those in a minute. Humanitarian needs, engineering development. We've actually advanced the capability of some of these systems beyond what the manufacturers can do at this point because our payload development and integration has allowed us to do so. Our goal is and always has been to meet Alaska's needs using the technology that we're developing. It expands well beyond Alaska, but the vast majority of what we have done has been here, working with Alaska agencies, working with Alaska companies, working with communities. And so you see some of them listed here. You may recall the delivery of fuel in Nome, and I'll show you that in a second. We flew this aircraft there, helped them figure out where to lay hose. We flew in Bethel just a couple weeks ago on an emergency response exercise. So let me go through some of those in particular here. Some of the value to the state, through competitive grants and contracts, the university's brought over $4.5 million into the state from federal agencies, from a variety of different sources, but we have lived on competitive grants and contracts. Now, some of that is certainly government money because it's coming through NOAA or National Science Foundation or whatever it might be, but the thing is, it's not Alaska funding that has done that. Alaska, however, did fund us last year, capital budget, to the tune of $5 million for the purpose of growing this center that we're building and for seeking selection as one of the FAA test sites. And we're working on that. As I said, I'll talk about that more in a few moments here. We already have three small company startups just in the last 2.5 years. Two aerospace companies have opened or are opening offices in Fairbanks to work with us on the unmanned aircraft activity. The one you see there, ARTC, ARTIC, or Atkinson Robotics and Technology Integration Corporation, I'm literally the first person besides the owner of the company to know the name because they only just selected it. I asked him yesterday, or day before yesterday, if I could reveal it, and he said, yes, you can. So they're going to open a whole new branch of Atkinson Aeronautical Technologies.
Excuse me, Representative Isaacson, we'd invite you to join us at the table if you'd like. And I'll just throw in while he's coming up that I am aware that there are two companies in the Mat-Su area that are working on issues related to this and additional interest as well. And are you aware of any other place in the state where there are companies that are working or have an interest in this to begin working in the field?
Well, I suspect you might be thinking of ATI, which is building a little plane on its own, the Resolution. Tim Vistra is the head of that company, and I'm not sure who the other specific to unmanned aircraft is, but I'm sure we're dealing with them because amongst our little team, we know most of the people in the state who are working with unmanned aircraft in one way or another.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have the name. I was just informed, so we can find that out.
Sure.
Thank you. I have another question as far as you mentioned some of that funding coming through the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware that across the country that private industry is putting money into this technology as well? I would imagine they are. And but you have not had, have you had private industry money as well?
Oh, yes, we have. We have done funded work for BP and have a long project ahead of us to continue that work. And again, I'll show you some of what we've done so far, where it's going. We just finished our first task with Chevron last week, so they are funding us for work. We have there's been all kinds of interest from, well, even other nations. Like I say, Greg's in Finland right now. We're going to Iceland in a couple of weeks to meet with them. On they want to set up a joint corporation that is Iceland 51% and Alaska 49%, so that we are not a foreign company, and then they can send us money to do things, which we like. So same thing with Finland. They're setting, not a company, but they're setting up to send us money. There are lots of companies in our list of teammates for the FAA test site proposal. ADS-B Technologies in Anchorage is one of them. Lockheed Martin Skunk Works has signed on as an important partner with us. We have not asked for exclusivity of these companies, but I know the Lockheed partnership is exclusive. And they've done that because they see that most of the exciting stuff going on is going on in Alaska right now. So Boeing won't sign up with anybody, but they say they definitely want to come and work on stuff here. So there are many, many companies out there. And right now it's growing so fast, our problem is keeping up. Having the people in the planes to actually go do the work. But we're going to figure it out.
Representative Isaacson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And sorry that I came in late, and it's good to see you, General. I was curious, and maybe this has already been answered, but have we discussed airspace issues, and has all that been rectified, or is that coming to a conclusion so that this can actually expand? Was that an early question?
No.
Through the chair, we haven't gotten that as yet. I haven't gotten to that point. We will talk about airspace to some degree in here, but I can address, if you have a more specific question, I can address that.
One of the problems of using UAVs, Poker Flat wanted to expand the application. I guess we were able to do it up north. You were able to do it up north. Some we were looking at maybe using Eielson space to home base some of these things. What's the current status of?
Through the chair, first of all, to explain to everyone how one gets airspace approval. To fly an unmanned aircraft in the national airspace today, you have to be a public entity and you have to be established and accepted by the FAA as that. And to do that, we had to get a letter from the Attorney General of the state establishing that we are an instrumentality of the state of Alaska. So we have that, and we've been accepted some time ago. Then you have to apply for a certificate of authorization or waiver to the normal rules for flying in the national airspace. We have had now 50 of those approved over the years. That's more than most, maybe more than anyone, other than the military themselves. And we have also done a great deal of flying in military restricted airspace, which does not require an application to the FAA. It requires access through range control of the military to get in. We have established a partnership with JPARC, Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, and we have schedulable access to the range. So we call up, tell them we want to be there if there's time available. They will give us access to the range, and they activate that range for us just as they would if they were flying manned helicopters or fighters or whatever. Okay. So now, to get a certificate of authority, we go through a process of telling the FAA what is the aircraft we're going to fly, who are the operators, what's their experience, what's the location we want to fly, how do we maintain safety, how do we ensure that any manned aviation is protected from us, that we have procedures that we will follow. We may have two or three interchanges back and forth. It goes through their traffic control, it goes through safety standards, and several other entities within the FAA. And then if we have satisfied all their questions, then they will grant us a COA. And then once we have a COA, and we have a COA right now right around Poker, we've got several others right now, but if I want to go flying in around Poker right now, 48 hours ahead of time, I establish a NOTAM, Notice to Airmen, and that Notice to Airmen is published just like any other potential risk to aviation is published. That might be as simple as a big bonfire. You could publish a NOTAM for that, for example. But for us, we're going to fly one of these and what it's going to be. And then each time we fly, 30 minutes before we fly, we call Anchorage Center and we call Fairbanks Airport and activate the airspace and tell them we are going to be flying in that airspace. Now, that doesn't stop anyone else from flying through there, but it's now our responsibility to make sure that we're out of their way. And then when we're finished flying for the day, we call them back and close the COA out, and our flight for the day is over. So does that help?
That does. And so that'll help in the commercialization through the chair. That'll help with the commercialization, I suppose, and accomplish what you're trying to do with this.
Again, through the chair, it is a step in the process. But what we don't have today is the ability, as a general aviation pilot could do, of filing a flight plan and going and flying. We have to go through all those other steps first. There's good reason for that. Safety is absolutely a paramount concern of the FAA, and it is ours as well. As I have said many, many, many times, I do not want to be in the first manned aircraft brought down by somebody's improperly handled unmanned aircraft. Okay? And so we are as dedicated to making sure that the rules developed and that will be developed through this test site, if we're selected, are in fact adequate and well thought out and well tested and thoroughly evaluated, and the safety has been assessed in every possible way. And the procedures that we establish for flying mean that the rigor is always there, that the operators are adequately trained and properly certified, and that the flying vehicle itself is certified to be safe for flying, has a robust link, and so forth. So we're not there yet. We have a way to get there, but it's not the way that it will ultimately be, and it should not be open to non-public entities until that way has been figured out and approved.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so let me go on now with some of the value. These are some of the companies who are working with us already, and we have over 50 partners to this test site in and outside Alaska, so there's a much bigger number, but a couple of these are the little ones who have started with us already. So what are some of the areas that we expect this will provide value to Alaska? These are the ones I have listed here. I'll talk specifically about some of them, but as you look at them, I don't have, for example, right now, a specific example of search and rescue. So we haven't gone out and done an actual search yet. We have done a demonstration of a search where we sent one of our team out in the woods just away from our administration building at Poker, and he laid down on the ground and did the victim shape on the ground thing, and we went out with this aircraft. And interesting, learned ourselves that the visual camera is almost useless, but the IR camera picked them up just like that, very, very quickly. And that was a demonstration we did for Alaska State Troopers, for the two individuals who are part of the task force. They have to look into a program for them. And they got pretty excited about the capability of this little system. And you can see how this would be suitable for carrying in a backpack and going out on a search. I actually did go out on a search for, it was for someone, it was for remains, not for a live person, so I couldn't get approval to fly because it's not an emergency.
Representative Thompson, please join us up at the table if you'd like.
I actually went out on one of these and gained some understanding about what we would have to do to actually bring an aircraft like this along. How many batteries we'd have to carry for being out for 8, 10, 12 hours and so forth. So there's some things we'll have to sort out to make it really work. But those are the things we're learning. Infrastructure monitoring is an area we are exploring with DHS and emergency management for the purpose of doing critical infrastructure assessment ahead of any disasters. Think of Cordova last year with all the snow that they got. If we knew from having done detailed 3D mapping, which we can do with these things, exactly where the roofs of those buildings were, you could assess exactly how structurally strong those are, again, ahead of time. And then when you have the snow, go back out, fly, and establish, okay, how much weight are we really seeing on there, and is that something we need to worry about? So there's many applications people don't think about that you could employ in Alaska and provide value, not just in Alaska, of course.
When I think of infrastructure, I think of the pipeline. Has an unmanned aircraft been used to monitor the pipeline up to this point?
Not yet, but what we have a project. The project we have with BP right now is not part of the big pipeline, but part of their pipeline structure around the drilling stations. And we're working on developing sensors that are able to detect the leaks from the pipeline prior to the point at which the 1% pressure difference is reached, which is all they can use right now to detect a leak. So the goal is to identify what sensors help us detect the different gases that are released, identify precisely where they are, miniaturize that sensor enough to fly on an aircraft, if not this, then some aircraft, and then establish the procedures that will allow them to use that. The goal, very much in that case, is to be able to go do assessment, get early detection of leaks, but also to eliminate the requirement to send a human in to what could be a very dangerous environment because of the gases that have been released, verify what's there, and then you know if they need to go in with a full suit or what they need to go in and actually do. So that's a funded project right now with BP. Ultimately, we'd like to see the ability to fly the pipeline. However, there are rules right now that don't allow you to fly that close to the pipeline. So those things will have to be worked out before we could actually do that. Before we have the sensor, there's not a lot of point in pushing those rules. But once we have the sensors, that will be a very logical and beneficial use of unmanned aircraft.
Thank you. And I guess infrastructure also, I think of the railroad, I think of the highways, flooding, things like that. Have they been used at this point for either highways or railroad?
Again, we have a project with DOT to go out and do our 3D mapping, which allows us to establish changes over time in unstable slope management. So that's one of the projects. We've actually got a proposal into DOT right now for exactly that. So, yes, the list is unending. Almost anything you can think of, you can find a use for these. In fact, well, let me show you some of them. Well, these are some of the reasons. We flew Arctic Edge in 2010, and the idea there was we could fly out, fly high. We could fly entirely over restricted airspace. We could see out 8 miles into Eagle River, and we could look at overpasses and make a determination, should, if we had a real earthquake going on, should you send a civil engineer out to assess that particular bridge? Or is it so destroyed, don't waste your time, let's deploy our limited talent only to the places where there's a possibility of restoring movement? So, I mean, it just goes on and on.
Representative Isaacson.
So, thank you. What's the range on this thing? I'm sure you mentioned it.
The Scout only has a 20-minute flight time.
Okay.
And its top speed is 31 knots, so not very far. But the Scan Eagle, which is what we're using for Arctic Edge, is 22 hours of duration and can fly up to 23,000 feet.
23, and how many miles away from control?
That's limited by radio line of sight, so we don't let it get any further away than that. And right now, it's also limited by the FAA rules of not flying beyond visual line of sight.
Madam Chair, follow up. On the previous slide, just before you got here, you mentioned that you can counter unilateral federal decisions with facts. Would you elaborate on that?
I certainly can. The feds closed the fishery out over the Aleutians based on their limited data, which was acquired by their once per year flying for 1 week looking at haulouts of stellar sea lions. The North Pacific Fisheries was convinced that, in fact, there were plenty of stellar sea lions out there. And so we flew for 3 weeks off of that boat that we had on that video you saw, for the purpose of counting stellar sea lions. Separately, biologists looked at the DNA of the animals there and the animals in southeast and found that they are the same animal, and there's ample of them in southeast as well. And so now North Pacific Fisheries is back in court with that data, proving that in fact stellar sea lions are not endangered. And assuming they are successful, will reopen a $600 million fishery.
Follow. And that was because taking a standard aircraft manned vehicle, it was just too noisy, the sea lions would slip out under the ice, or what was the factor that made this more successful than other methods, satellite, manned vehicles, etc.?
Through the chair. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting to do that. Manned aircraft can't get far enough away from land to see the entire Aleutian chain. The weather conditions mean that satellites don't see very well. In fact, most of the satellites, a pixel is 1 kilometer, and you really can't count animals accurately enough to be able to do that. So this, we could fly off a boat, we could fly under the weather, we can fly in a short moment of time where the weather's good enough, and then we're back on board and go back out. We could loiter because we're coming off of a loiter on the boat and launch when the conditions were right. We could be out there for a long period of time for much less cost than trying to get a suitable manned aircraft to get out that far and be there for that amount of time.
One final follow-up. Mm-hmm. Do you envision any other application in this category?
Through the chair, yes. We have been asked to figure out if we would be able to go help count polar bears.
Representative Higgins.
And thank you, Madam Chair. You might have asked this question already. What's the length and time that you can fly one of these? How far out can you go and for how long?
Through the chair, these are currently able to fly for a 20-minute flight. Now, some of that time you're spending going and coming, so it's pretty short. They can fly up to 31 miles an hour, depending on wind. That limits how far forward you can actually go, of course. But we are currently developing some battery technology. We're hoping to double that or maybe triple that time.
Okay. Follow up. So, like I was telling you earlier, I mostly crash my planes, my model airplanes. But So when you're controlling this, mm-hmm. So you can go, I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out, what's your control status? You know, I mean, you can go out, are they satellite controlled or what?
Through the chair, these are, We have a base station. This is the base station. Normally it has a battery on it just like this, but I didn't bring one today. Depending on where we situate this affects how far away it can get from where we're physically located, but we do have a line of sight requirement right now.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
So that doesn't mean we can't do it. We've flown beyond line of sight when we're flying in restricted airspace, and we've been given permission to fly beyond line of sight when we're flying from a boat. Not with this so much, but with the Scan Eagle, we were allowed to fly out to 5 miles away from the boat, which is the furthest away from anything in beyond line of sight that the FAA had approved to date. That was back in 2009. So the expectation is, as we figure out how to solve the problem of sense and avoid or see and avoid, which means how do we know when somebody else is there and avoid them appropriately, then we're going to find restrictions like that. But there's a lot of people working the technology to try and solve that problem.
Can you talk a little bit about how that's progressing? I was reading about that. Do you think that is something they're going to come up with technology to resolve the see and avoid issue fairly soon, or is it quite complicated?
It is a complicated but not impossible solution. what we believe is that it's going to be a combination of techniques that will ultimately be the right solution. All of this is about risk. So it's all about how big is the risk to start with, what's the probability of it occurring, and what can you do to mitigate the risk, okay? So when you look at sense and avoid, you're looking at the methods for reducing the risk. Now, the risk of bringing down a 747 with a scout are kind of slim. You'd have to be really good at aim. You'd have to be up where they are, which can't happen because they can't fly that high. You know, so you can say the risk is low. So what do I have to do to mitigate that risk? Well, in that case, maybe I'm fine, but stay under 400 feet because there's no manned aircraft under 400 feet. They're not supposed to be anyway. In a higher flyer, then we're looking at auxiliary systems like a radar system, which we have actually developed, the IPAS, and that allows us to see out to 12 miles. In that case, we can see a Scan Eagle. This can't go that far, but if it could, we wouldn't be able to see this. It's too little. But we've also integrated into it a transponder, interrogator, and receiver. And so if an aircraft has a transponder on it, we can interrogate that transponder, and we know that aircraft is there, and we know where it is. And we'll watch for it with the radar operator. We'll watch for it so that we know where it is, and we can make sure that we keep our unmanned system away from where that aircraft is coming in. The ability to directly detect another aircraft from the unmanned aircraft is where a lot of the work is going on right now. And that's down the road a little, mainly because of the technology of miniaturizing. There's plenty of technology for detecting things, but it's too big to put on little things. So that will come, but it's not quite there.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was fascinating to watch the landing on the moving boat a few minutes ago. And the sense and avoid technology is not yet developed to that point. That was human guided flight and recapture of the scout on the boat, right? You don't yet have the sense and avoid technology.
Through the chair again, the sense and avoid is more about detecting other things.
Mm-hmm.
This is sufficiently autonomous that if I don't have to capture it on a boat, which means reach up and grab it, and that's a hard thing to do, you saw why.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's landing on a piece of land, I touch the land button and it lands. I don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's very autonomous. So there's a little bit of difference between hand piloting it, the actual operation of the system, whatever the system is, and there's degrees of that autonomy, and the sense and avoid part, which is mainly looking out. And the avoid part eventually they're hoping to get is an automated avoidance system. So if this sees something else coming along, it makes some kind of avoidance maneuver and stays away from whatever else is out there.
If I might, I think I was referring to the fact that it avoided the superstructure on the boat, the rigging.
That was
swinging and it was right there.
Through the chair. That is the operator paying attention through the camera looking at where it is. Yes, you're right.
Okay, great. It was really impressive.
I'm curious, as the sense and avoid technology develops, whether we will see a second person needed on the ground, especially for the larger unmanned aircraft. as a safety feature, and I know that, that FAA requires now pilot intervention capabilities. Do you foresee that it might require, just like with a large aircraft, you would have a second pilot, that, that there might be required a second person on the ground rather than one?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because actually they require it today.
Two?
They do. We have a pilot who's doing the actual operating, and we have an observer. And so when you saw Greg out there trying to catch it on the boat, the pilot was inside. But we have a requirement to have a pilot and observer all the time.
And does that observer have to be, do they both have to be licensed pilots?
If you're flying one of the big aircraft, you do have to have a license as a manned general aviation pilot right now. Because most of what you do with these aircraft really doesn't require you to know how to fly. It's more like gaming than it is like flying an airplane, truly. We're hoping to get to a point where the training is about adequate training on the individual system and substantial training on how to be in the airspace, how to interact with other systems, how to interact with air traffic control, how to read the maps, how to properly file your plans, and that's that sort of training. But today, to fly above 400 feet, you need to be a pilot. To fly under, you do not.
And what you mentioned the larger aircraft. What size do we it defines larger when you talked about what you just explained?
The FAA is supposedly going to be coming out soon with what they call a small UAS rule, and they're defining that as either under 55 pounds or under 25 pounds. We've heard both things. For law enforcement, we've definitely heard under 25 pounds. We in the community pretty well talk about 55 and under as being small. Above that, you're getting to needing runways. You need quite a bit more infrastructure to actually do the operation. Something like a Predator or a Reaper or a Global Hawk, you need, you know, Air Force level stuff.
And I'm sorry, you probably mentioned it, but the Scan Eagle, what's the weight of that one?
It's a 40-pound fixed wing, 10-foot wingspan, catapult launched aircraft.
And another question, and we'll let you get through your slides, but you mentioned the training, and it's more like gaming, so I'm thinking there might be some young people very interested in this. Are we seeing in universities across the country where there are courses where people are a track where young people can start to follow to go into this field?
We are, and we're hoping to develop some more of that at UAF as well. University of North Dakota has started a training program already for operators. I think there's one or two others that have already done that. We have allocated some of the money we got from the capital budget last year to education and outreach, and we're actually hiring a faculty member who is part-time engineering, part-time Geophysical Institute where we're located, to do unmanned aircraft things and to begin to build that kind of a capability, mostly on the engineering side right now, but ultimately potentially moving into the operator side. I would envision if the university did an operator training program for unmanned aircraft, we would probably do that at UAA because they have pilot training. We don't have it. But we'll see. Slide one. Okay. I'm probably going to recover some of the things we've talked about, but that's fine. So why unmanned? I mean, some people ask, why can't we just do this with manned aircraft? And we have had a little of that conversation already. But we tend to say the place you want to involve unmanned aircraft is where the work you want to do is dirty, dull, or dangerous. Okay? And so where the work is very risky. And, of course, we have a lot of remote and extreme terrain, and we have a lot of extreme and volatile weather conditions here. We have unreachable locations here, which makes unmanned aircraft an ideal solution for many of those situations. I've listed one accident here, but there are many cases where we have lost very talented scientists who are out trying to collect data. For dirty work, observation over chemical spills, wildfire smoke, volcanoes, and so forth, that's work that you don't want to send a manned system into. And the other, the dull part, much of what we will do is mapping. and that involves taking literally tens of thousands of photographs overlapping 70%, going along a grid pattern that's very rigid, and for the average human, that is excruciatingly boring. So it's an ideal thing for doing that. And you can see some of the other ones that I have listed there. What we offer, of course, is massive amounts of airspace with not a lot of things in it. We've got lots and lots of terrain that doesn't have a whole lot of people in it. So we can fly over that and be confident that we're not putting infrastructure or people at risk. And that makes us a good place to try this stuff out. It really is. We have access to the military ranges, as I've already indicated, and they've got great data gathering capability, which they've agreed to let us use. And, of course, we like to brag about our pioneering aviation history, and we want to be still on the forefront of that in unmanned systems. And maybe our willingness as a state to be thoughtful and methodical about how we go about establishing policy around this, that may turn out to be one of the most important things that we have here, because there's a lot of knee-jerk activity going on outside. So our vision, you can see it here. I don't need to read it to you, but our job is to figure out for the future how can this technology be used and what do we need to do so it's used well and properly for our benefit. And our mission statement, you can see a number of the different systems. The one on the upper left is a Scan Eagle. You can kind of see the size. Let's see, we've got the second from the right on the bottom is a Puma. The one on the far right is a Gatewing, aircraft built in Belgium that we've worked with some. It was actually bought by Tanana Chiefs. The far left is a Maverick. That's a little hand launch that's built in Canada. We don't own all of these, by the way, but we've been involved with them one way or another over time. So let's see what we've done. So ICEAL population, this is one of the first ones that we did off of a ship. This was a Scan Eagle launched off of the MacArthur. And actually, if people have time afterwards, I have videos of a lot of this stuff, but I didn't want to take up that much time, so I didn't include any but the one you already saw at the beginning. One of the big things we saw here is that contrary to what they see with manned aircraft, which is usually helicopters off of a flight deck on a ship, instead of all the SEALs being up on their flippers and looking up or diving over the side, they ignored us completely. And the one picture you can see there, that's pretty typical. They had no idea we were there. So that makes for a more accurate count, which gets back to what Representative Isaacson was talking about, countering unilateral decisions with real data. Stellar Sea Lions, I already talked about this one. This is what we did with the Scout. And the movie you saw, our preliminary findings are limited, listed there along with what I already said, that we found there's lots of them out there. Crazy Mountain Complex wildfire, this was in summer of 2009. Manned aviation hadn't flown for 5 days due to smoke. So we actually got an emergency call for this one, and we were able to provide the incident commander with 3-hour-old data on where exactly the fire boundaries were, GPS coordinates. We could tell them that structures were not threatened. We could tell them that it had not jumped Birch Creek. And we could tell them how the fire was behaving at night when it should be down in the duff. The picture on the left there is actually of a tree candling, which is not usually what you see at night. So that was a little bit different. But it gave them information they couldn't have gotten any other way. Salmon spawning, this was something we did this past fall in Idaho. The goal was to determine whether the salmon nests were as extensive as they expected them to be. It's a very difficult area to map because manned aircraft can't get into the canyons. They're very deep, very threatening canyons with incredible wind conditions. We had some fun with that too, but we were able to do it. But here's a picture that we were able to take. And the point was to see how many nests are there. And there you can see what we found. You can actually see when you're looking at it zoomed in that there is a female on each nest. So this can be of value to us as well, as we see fisheries or we see limitations on catches and stuff. There's things we could do with this that could be very useful. That's all the picture you could get from the satellite, is the larger picture. The little insert is that spot that we were able to map down to centimeter level resolution by comparison with the what you can see from the satellite picture. Arx Qadri, this is when I was on in November. We were down at Eglin Air Force Base. Three different unmanned aircraft systems were flown along with two manned systems all at the same time. We had an airboss for that one. This is restricted airspace, so we could do that. There's no way we could get approval to do that from the FAA right now. We did it with strict separation. I was allowed to fly up to 400 feet, and the only other thing I had to watch out for was the tethered balloon in my area where I was flying. And then we had the Scan Eagle. These were all set fires, and the purpose was to collect data on fire behavior with different fuel types, weather conditions, humidity conditions, and so forth. So they had nine different fires. And Greg actually went down and briefed our results about a month and a half ago, I think it was. And there's a lot of excitement about using this technology for more of that kind of research. This was the exercise we just did in Bethel with the Guard and FEMA. And we went out, camped out in the exercise area where it was 20 below. We learned that laptops do not like 20 below. They want to be warm. The airplane was fine. We could fly the airplane absolutely fine. But when we tried to download the data and do some processing in the laptops, they weren't happy. And those were ordinary laptops, not the system hardware. But it was pretty interesting. We were able to, these are pictures that we took. One on the left, you can actually see the aircraft in there if you look real close. But the infrared of the camp on the top there, you can see where at night you could go out with this with an infrared camera and find survivors. They really show up. So it's very useful. They were pretty impressed with that capability. We learned a lot. It was pretty challenging for us. But, you know, you learn how to deal with it after you do it a few times. This is the BP partnership, Shoreline Cleanup. They're actually the first ones who bought one of these, and after we saw what it could do, we got a couple of them. We're the only ones who can fly it for them, but they own one. So, but the purpose of this is if there's an oil spill offshore, then they would deploy their unmanned aircraft, they would go get detailed pictures of the shoreline before the oil got there, so they would have the ability after cleanup to say, we're done. And here's how we know we're done, because it looks like it did before. So that's a pretty good technology use. This is infrastructure monitoring. This is the part on the left is what we were talking about with monitoring the pipeline. One of the things we were concerned about is this is a helicopter. If you've ever been underneath a helicopter, you know that it displaces an awful lot of air. And what we didn't want was to get so close to a spill that we would disperse what was there, and therefore our sensors wouldn't be able to pick it up. So the box with all those funny little lines in it was a mathematical model of what they thought the dispersion would actually be. And then we actually generated smoke, flew the aircraft. It's not flying. It's not actually flying. It's on a stick, because that way we could control real precisely where it was. And based on that, then they're analyzing the data to figure out, did the actual movement of air caused by the helicopter follow the model that they had? On the right, it's a little bit hard to see, but those are flare stacks, and there's a piece that goes in the top of those flare stacks that they periodically have to assess and potentially replace. It costs about $500,000 each one of those. What they have to be built custom-made, and it takes a couple months to get them built. But there's no way to go look and see what condition they're in without shutting it down, because they're prohibited from flying manned aircraft nearby because of the risk. But we could fly this thing over there, and in 20 minutes we had all the data they needed. They had one that had to be replaced. Two did not have to be replaced. So save them $1 million just like that in 20 minutes. Another use that you can use these for is to assist in piloting through ice. I imagine you're aware of the Sikulyak, which is a ship being built to be hosted in Seward. It's a research vessel owned by National Science Foundation. I will be going out on ice trials with that next March when it gets here. for the purpose of seeing if the Scout and maybe one other aircraft system are able to help them go through ice. It's an icebreaker, but it's a light icebreaker. And the next slide can show you the intended path of the ship that this is about was that nice straight green line there. That red one is where they actually went, based on what they could see from the bridge and what they could see from the satellite imagery, which is what you see in the background. The bright spots are ice ridges. And so, but here's what you can see with what we can build with our imagery. And now you can see real ridges and be able to tell a much better job of where you'd be able to go safely through the ice. Now that was from a Raven. That was not from this system. Raven's a little fixed-wing, battery-operated. I mentioned this one already. In this case, our job was to help them deploy the hose to avoid areas that might cut that hose, ice ridges and such, to be able to monitor for polar bears and other risks like open leads that might occur where people are trying to travel, then to just document the site so they'd know what they had, and of course, public affairs wants pictures, always. So that was pretty successful. That was last year ago, January. This is the radar system I mentioned earlier that we've developed. We started with surplus radars from the Army. We developed a display and then integrated the transponder interrogator system on board so that we now have the ability to monitor airspace. This system's actually been certified by NASA for use as our primary radar during our rocket launch operations at Poker Flat. And it was actually funded by the FAA Tech Center. So this is hopefully at some point that's going to be accepted as part of the mitigation strategies that we can use. Ongoing project going on right now. This is one of working with Airborne Technologies, ATI, to detect marine debris as it's coming over from the tsunami. So we've done some flying with that already. Our biggest operation will be this summer. Another project, marginal ice zone, ocean and ice observations. This is being set up by NASA and NOAA, and it's partially for the purpose of pushing the FAA into allowing some more interesting operations like multiple aircraft operating simultaneously. This is going to be out in international waters, and so getting approval to fly out there in the areas that the FAA has air traffic control capability with. So that's a lot of different projects. We've also done for the troopers, as I mentioned earlier, a demonstration of the Scout and showing what we could be doing with that. Their initial interest, we've been told, collect forensic evidence at crash or crime scenes. The advantage there is if you have a major accident on a highway and we can get all of the photographic data necessary in a 20-minute flight, you can reopen that highway hours faster because they've got what they need for the to be able to reconstruct what happened there. Search and rescue I've already talked about. Wildlife protection is another area, and there will be others, but that's where we're starting at this point. Our role there is to provide expertise with unmanned aircraft to them as they work out their concept of operations, provide support to that as we can, and help them with a training package so that, and then potentially where would they do it? It might be on one of our areas where we have COAs, it might be on restricted airspace. Those things are all to come. So, and then also working with them on where we know people who have an understanding of the privacy issues to shorten the time for them to get those things sorted out. This was the Columbia River one that was just a week ago. See, this is another capability which we're basically the only university that's capable of doing this right now, to go out and collect information in some of these extremely remote areas. I'm going to keep going because these things can go on forever. There's a lot of them. Okay, the test site. I want to talk about that just a little bit. In the 2012 Reauthorization Act, the FAA was directed to select six test sites to research and test for safe integration into the airspace. And they finally got that solicitation out on Valentine's Day, and we have put together the team I've identified there with all kinds of different folks involved, including most of the people you have on the task force in the resolution, as it turns out. We've already turned in one volume for this. We've got four more due on the 28th of March, another one on the 11th of April, and the final volume on the 6th of May. And so my team is back there working furiously to get all that stuff put together for them. And then we hope that December 31st we'll have a nice New Year's gift of, or earned, earned selection, so that we will be one of the test sites. Rumors have it we're in pretty good stead for it based on all the work we've done, because we've really done more than pretty much anybody else, but we'll see. This is what we're calling ourselves, a Pan-Pacific UAS Test Range Complex. It's an awkward name, but it does kind of say what it is. There are 14 specific test ranges within the test site, and most of them in Alaska. Strong link with JPARC. And we've asked some of the premier safety, aviation safety people in the state to be part of the team so that we really do get out and take advantage of these experts and make this as safe as we can. And you can see the key questions that are listed there. We have talked about all of these today already. So privacy. I know this is a big interest area. I know this is what kind of got you started on some of this already. And I wanted to talk about that some. We are very dedicated to making sure privacy is adequately protected. And we particularly want to make sure that it's addressed appropriately so the beneficial uses don't get shut down. Which is an obvious concern. One writer that I read about compared where we are in UAS technology and manufacturing in this country to where we were going into World War II and right after World War II with manned aviation. If naysayers had gotten ahead of the technology at that time and the U.S. had lost its leadership in aviation, you have to wonder where we'd be as a nation today. Well, this isn't quite the same, but it's similar. It is a new technology, but the big benefit we have is an awful lot of what had to be worked out with manned aviation applies here as well. Furthermore, the Constitution of the United States, Fourth Amendment, has done a really great job of adequately dealing with issues as all kinds of new technologies have come along over the years. I mean, think about the invention of portable cameras. Well, we don't think about that because everybody's got one or two or three nowadays. What did that do for privacy? They worked it out. What about manned aviation with the ability to fly over your house or to fly over, you know, private reserve of some kind? Well, they worked those things out. What about paparazzi? You know, the least favorite operators of aircraft in pretty much the world, I think. Well, they have been limited in what they can do because it's been worked out in the courts. So there's a lot of statutory provisions and a great deal of case law all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court that have established where any aircraft can actually be, where it can't be, where you have an expectation and a right to privacy, and where you don't. And so much of that is going to adequately protect here as well. However, there are some gaps. We know this doesn't make as much noise as a helicopter that's got people on it. We know that. And it can go places very quietly, you know, so those things need to be dealt with as well. But you get to some other rules, and, you know, I know that Commissioner Brayback is back there, and he knows a whole lot more about this than I do, but there's warrant rules, and there's peeping Tom laws, and those things apply just as much with technology as they do with a human walking up to your window and looking in. And so what we have to find now is where are those gaps that are unique to unmanned aircraft, and how do we establish the appropriate procedures to make sure that privacy is still protected, that we still meet the provisions of the Constitution and the laws that are out there. We know National Institute for Justice, which is a program arm of the Department of Justice, and Department of Homeland Security have committed to taking this on and define what the specific rules ought to be. Now, that's at the federal level, so that doesn't necessarily mean it covers everything that we will ultimately need here. FAA says in the solicitation that we're responding to right now, there is a paragraph reserved for the privacy provisions that will get inserted once they've got something worked out. And we're expecting to see that in June. At least that's when they said they were going to have something for us. And I can tell you as well that DOD and guard training on domestic privacy is not only underway, but they've got it scheduled for us next week. So when we go fly with the guard, that we are appropriately trained and that we will not violate what actually come in under intelligence, the Intelligence Committee of the Congress, and the intelligence gathering rules that are out there.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, General, we talked about this in the hall, but just to put it on the record so you can reiterate what you said, back in the day when I was in the Air Force and my specialty was collecting voice communications, when we had any communications capturing voices of Americans, we had to destroy the tapes. I was concerned because after 9/11, those domestic spying criteria were greatly relaxed, and in fact we heard that Americans were being permitted, it was being permitted to spy on Americans. You told me what you just said to us again, and would you reiterate the difference between an executive order and congressional oversight and the work of the committees again, and what the status is, and whether or not Alaskans need to be afraid of having these devices being used as spy, you know, the government spying on us.
Sure. Through the chair, from our viewpoint, the Congress and the Intelligence Committee rules on these things in the sense that they establish what are the provisions that the military, which is who is guided by this, from my own experience, but I don't believe it's just the military. That's just my own experience and all I'm willing to speak to on. But the military is still actively training about destroying tapes, just as whether it's voice tape or visual, about the separation between domestic and foreign. Posse comitatus is still in existence, and that posse comitatus is a specific role that says that the military cannot be used for domestic police work. Okay, so and where they've wanted to use military technology in support of some kind of, this is mostly drugs, is where it has been used, mostly Gulf of Mexico area and south, where drugs are coming into the country. They've had to have other agencies on board, and that's all of who's allowed to actually collect information or anything. So from the military perspective, that privacy is rigorously protected, and the separation between domestic and overseas or foreign operations is rigorously defined, and they're actively training on it. Like I said, I mean, they're literally putting a program together for our team so that we can go out with them and be properly trained. The Patriot Act is, I think, what you're referring to as rules that were changed after 9/11. That is an act of Congress and did change some rules. And I'm not qualified or prepared at the moment to go into detail on that sort of thing. But it may be that we discover that the federal government thinks it ought to do some of those things, in which case the state of Alaska, in my non-expert opinion, would have the opportunity and the desire and the ability to pass laws that would in some way limit that capability. But I'm not someone who is qualified to say whether they would or not. What comes to mind is some of the bills that have been introduced here and elsewhere to make elements of gun control currently being contemplated illegal in the state. So presumably you could do something like that with this.
And I'll just interject, you know, even yesterday in the U.S. Congress, the Senate Judiciary was looking at this very subject. So we may see something come out of Congress again on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
It is evolving. The policy is right along with the technology.
And some other areas, the International Association of Chiefs of Police issued guidelines for law enforcement use of unmanned aircraft systems. That's in your handout here. You can see what the full text is, but the essence is follow the rules. There must be strict supervisory oversight and accountability throughout. If there's any potential that information being gathered could be of a consequence in crime investigation or something of that sort, then warrants are necessary. Tell people you're going to go fly over them, which is what we do too, and then delete the recordings that are not authorized. So, I mean, that's pretty much along the same line as what you were talking about, Representative Isaacson, with regard to things that were collected by the military voice recordings back then. It's pretty much the same thing. Delete it if you didn't specifically have a reason to get it and appropriate permissions. So, as I say, we're working with DPS to assist with their program. And, I mean, it was one of the first things that Major Levesque brought up to me is we have some concerns about how we handle recordings and things like that. So they're working with their general counsel already to make sure that they're doing that in an appropriate way.
And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Brigadier General, but that there is work of some of the folks that we do actually have in the listed in the task force that are currently working on this, that over the summer there's going to be work on suggested policy that we may even see something at the state level by mm-hmm. this fall.
Yes, that's right. I believe it's the group that the Lieutenant Governor is on. I've forgotten the proper name of the, I think you have it listed here somewhere, but in the resolution even. But, my understanding is they're working on exactly that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So that will be an ongoing conversation here, and we'll have a chance to have input.
This question always comes up, and so, you know, there's just no point in avoiding it. I figured I'd just put it right up front, and we'll talk about it. There's a lot of media scares out there, you know, and why is that? Well, it's pretty obvious. The entrance of unmanned aircraft to the awareness of the public came through what the military was doing overseas. And those are weaponized, and they are, they have become the image. Everything you see is a Predator or a Reaper out there with a weapon on it. They don't show the Global Hawk, which doesn't have weapons at all. It's nothing but an observation platform. But it's not going to happen with us. For one thing, the unmanned aircraft community is totally against this. It absolutely would destroy any ability for us to go out and beneficially use these for all the other things that I've shown you today. And there, as you saw, a long, long list. Secondly, there's not much that this can carry, truthfully. Really, there's not much that they can carry, even the bigger ones. And the FAA prohibits it entirely. In fact, the specifics are applicable to manned aircraft as well. It is impermissible. It is not allowed to drop any kind of an object from an aircraft, which, by the way, would include a bullet or anything else you can think of. So an IACP, International Association of Chiefs of Police, itself, advises against even considering. They see it's unlikely technologically, but it's almost certainly unacceptable to the public, and we absolutely adhere to that.
I just want to make you aware we're down to, we have about, if you could wrap up in about 5 minutes and before you go mm-hmm. on, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, quick question on that. So maybe even a larger system that you have there.
Mm-hmm.
What about if instances of being able to utilize them for, say, avalanche control?
Mm-hmm.
You know, dropping, they don't. Dropping something, you know, in that case, a small explosive device to help the avalanche. Right now, you might have, you're trying to shoot something up, or you mm-hmm. got guys that might go up there and try to throw them. I mean, are we completely not able to do something even in that capacity, which is a function of life saving, but
mm-hmm.
I know. And I get people concerned about some of this other stuff.
Well, through the chair, I would have to say that I never thought about that one at all. But since there are other ways of doing it, our reaction to start with would be, well, use the other ways. Just as we will say, don't use an unmanned aircraft if a manned aircraft can do it as easily or more cheaply, we would say, if there are other means of doing this, don't put it on an unmanned aircraft. Just don't even go there. And I would be very open to simply prohibiting it.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, you know, and I'm not thinking more of Alaskan resorts, but if you go down to, you know, Colorado and Utah and some of the others, they'll actually have their patrolmen, their ski patrol actually climb up, in some cases, some of the mountains that they have, which is obviously an inherent danger to those personnel, when maybe there's an opportunity to utilize, in the same manner that we're trying to utilize these systems for safety in not having people on a plane or whatnot. I'm just thinking that there may be opportunities there that current law may prohibit that could save or keep safety intact for a certain, in that case, safety personnel. Something to think about that I think that is interesting to add to this discussion.
Chair, I would agree. It's a very interesting thing to add. I guess my thinking is, first, I want to be able to go fly them. Then we can talk about expanding uses, maybe a very special permit. I think I used to live in Utah, and I knew they had to have special permits to even get the ammunition they used because it was military ammunition that's normally not released outside of the military. They demil it. So, you know, it may be something like that could come along, but that's purely speculative on my part.
Well, my goal is that you guys would be the ones, you know, figuring all that out. Let's not let someone in another state figure that out.
Okay.
Let's be the experts.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I actually only have one more slide, so it's perfect. I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you for what you're doing with the resolution. We very much appreciate the recognition of our work. We've been working awful hard for a long time, and our goal really has always been for the benefit of our state. And while you've seen some of those benefits, it's the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more we can do. So there's that impression of danger out there. Going at this in a thoughtful and methodical way, giving us the task force to help figure it out for the state and letting us participate in that, we're very grateful. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, General. This is the Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism Committee. So why is this? Are we talking about this? And that was one of the things as I began to study. I realized there's potential here for Alaska. And in my reading, the projected number of jobs nationwide expected in the next 3 years, as this really launches off the ground, which is a pun, I guess. Is 70,000 to 105,000 jobs initially, and then going up from there. I'd like a piece of that pie for Alaska. That $13 billion impact will go along with that. You know, like a piece of the pie for that. So again, back to the harnessing for good and the economic potential for us. And right now, just public entities can be authorized, but there's a lot of commercial interest in this too, and there's potential there. So I do think it's something important that we work out and that we keep our minds open, ever vigilant as far as the privacy concerns, and that we put in place those policies to fill any gaps that might be out there. So do any other members have any comments? Well, we just want to thank you, General, for being here. I encourage you, I don't know if you or Greg will be available to be online Tuesday when we have the hearing, but encourage there may be questions that come up as we look specifically at the legislation. But thank you very, very much. And before we close out here, I just want to let you know that we are trying to firm up dates for what we will call a tour of Alaska. And we only heard back from two offices. So if your office hasn't replied to my staff, Ginger, please do that. And so we can set that up and get our calendar set for here before too long. And one of the things I thought this, I mentioned to someone in the hall, this particular presentation today was nice oil tax reform relief, just something a little different. So just a kind of a good thing for the day. And so thank you very much. And with that, we will adjourn at 12:40.